This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, July 9, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Congress gears up for another battle over the war in Iraq as Jordan and Syria plead for more money for Iraqi refugees. We'll hear about a referendum in Turkey that could result in allowing the people to elect their own president. And 13 community members are charged with terrorism in El Salvador after peacefully protesting against water privatization. Those stories and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. President Bush has once again invoked executive privilege to keep former White House staffers from testifying under oath before open sessions of Congress. The Judiciary Committees of the House and the Senate are seeking testimony from former White House counsel Harriet Myers and former political director Sarah Taylor as part of the investigation into the dismissals of eight U.S. attorneys. The Bush administration has offered members of Congress to interview both former aides off the record and behind closed doors. White House counsel Fred Fielding today informed congressional investigators that the president will not provide documentation to back up his claim of executive privilege, which opens the doors to a possible contempt of Congress citation. With heightened fears of terrorism following the recent attacks in Britain, Germany's interior minister has called for tougher anti-terrorism laws, including preemptive detention and even assassination of terror suspects. Cinnamon Nipot reports from Berlin.
Interior Minister Wolfgang Schäuble from Chancellor Angela Merkel's centre-right political party, the Christian Democratic Union, is Germany's most vocal advocate of harsher anti-terror laws. Schäuble's new proposals include deploying the German army in domestic operations and searching suspects' computers without their knowledge. He also says that Germany should follow the US example by classifying terror suspects as enemy combatants in order to detain them without charge, and that there may be cases where it's appropriate to kill suspected terrorists. This is despite the fact that the death penalty is forbidden in Germany. Schäuble's comments have provoked shock and outrage throughout the country. Social Democrats leader Kurt Beck responded by saying, "We mustn't kill liberty in an effort to defend it." Konrad Freiberg from the German Police Union says German anti-terror laws are already tough enough and that Schäuble's suggestions are irresponsible and motivated by party politics. Cinnamon Nippard reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Berlin.
Campaigners are celebrating today after the news that Britain's controversial government arms sale body, the Defence Export Services Organisation, is to be disbanded. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
This secretive government body has had a long history of scandal. Most recently, it was accused of approving and facilitating £1 billion worth of bribes to Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia from British arms company BAE. The Defence Export Services Organisation was set up in 1966 when the arms industry was still largely state-owned. It subsidises and helps the highly profitable British arms industry sell around £5 billion worth of equipment a year to foreign governments. The British government now believes such close involvement in the selling of arms to developing countries with appalling human rights records is damaging Britain's reputation. Didier is a campaigner in exile from what he calls the undemocratic Republic of the Congo.
You know, the arm market selling weapons throughout the world is a big, big industry here in the UK. In the Congo, we've got 3 million people that died. This is the highest death toll since the Second World War. UK must know that they are creating wars, they are supporting wars, and unfortunately, if you're supporting the butchers, you are a butcher too.
Campaigners hope today's move will limit unacceptable levels of access by the arms companies to government. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The standoff between Pakistani security forces and armed militants inside of Islamabad's Red Mosque has continued into its seventh day today. The government sent a team of negotiators to communicate with the holdouts over loudspeaker, but no progress was reported. Those inside include women and children, students from the mosque's religious schools. 21 people have already died in the standoff. The mosque has generated controversy in Pakistan for its calls to implement Sharia law in Islamabad and for vigilante-style attacks against perceived violators of public morality. Special police units in Zimbabwe have arrested more than 1,300 shopkeepers for removing merchandise after Zimbabwe's ruling party imposed price controls on many basic goods in an attempt to put the brakes on the country's economic crisis. From neighboring South Africa, Tanegise reports.
Independent economists say prices in Zimbabwe today are 200 times higher than in January. Basics like food and transportation are well beyond the reach of most people. In several parts of the country, there are reports that farm workers, among the country's lowest wage earners, now prefer to exchange their work directly for food and clothing. Gumbo Hopewell is with Zimbabwe's Coalition on Debt and Development.
We're in a situation now the government is no longer in control of the basic government apparatus of providing health, providing education, and all those facilities. And what probably remains under his control by virtue of intimidation remains the army and the police.
A quarter of Zimbabwe's population is thought to have fled the country. The UN estimates that 4 million Zimbabweans will need food aid in the next year.
So how many more statistics should we give of the people who are dying in Zimbabwe today of hunger?
Activist Grace Kwinje was savagely battered by police at a protest rally in March and is now in exile in South Africa. The wave of state violence has subsided, but Kwinje believes the international community should be doing much more.
At what point are we going to give that resolution that not one person should be tortured, should be beaten up for what they believe in?
For FSRN, I'm Tae Nagyuse.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Congress is gearing up for another battle over the war in Iraq. With recent opposition by three GOP senators, Democratic leaders hope there's enough momentum to change Iraq policy. Meanwhile, peace groups are also gearing up for the war debate, engaging their members of Congress. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell has more.
The Iraq war debate will take place in the context of the defense authorization bill. It aids the Congress in the passage of an upcoming defense funding bill expected to total nearly $600 billion this year. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid places the burden in the hands of the Republicans, especially the three senators, Jed Gregg, Pete Domenici, and Richard Lugar, who recently expressed opposition to the war in Iraq.
For those Senate Republicans who are saying the right things on Iraq, they must put their words into action by voting with us to change course and responsibly end this war.
Senator Reid is creating the parameters for the debate. It will include troop rest and readiness provisions and a timeline for troop withdrawal. What it won't include, says Reid, is a precipitous withdrawal of all U.S. troops. Even the most extensive withdrawal idea offered, the only one to include funding cuts, the Reid-Feingold Amendment by Senators Reid and Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, would still leave thousands of troops in Iraq to fight al-Qaeda and for security purposes. And that amendment might not even get offered. Senator Reid said discussions have been ongoing about how extensive the timeline provisions will be.
We will see what happens with Levin Reid, what the language is on that, and the decision will be made on that later.
Senator Carl Levin, the author of a withdrawal timeline amendment, has said in the past that he does not support it being tied to funding. Meanwhile, groups working to end the Iraq war are gearing up for this next round of debates in Congress. Military Families Speak Out is organizing vigils and office visits to their representatives and trying to engage the public to support funding cuts. Nancy Lesson is co-founder of the group.
One of our biggest jobs now is to disconnect funding for the war and funding for the troops and say, you know, once again, funding this war is killing our troops, and what you need to do is not one more penny for continuing the war in Iraq and appropriate all monies needed to bring our troops home quickly and safely and take care of them when they get here.
Many of these groups are rallying support among their members, partly due to skepticism of members of Congress. They say the debate is being watered down to appease Republican defectors. One way is through an amendment offered by Ken Salazar, Democrat of Colorado, that would implement some of the recommendations of the Iraq Study Group. Tom Andrews is a former member of Congress and current president of Win Without War Coalition.
And some of these proposals, like the Salazar proposal, the Salazar Amendment, that could leave tens of thousands of U.S. troops behind in Iraq, but just redefine them from combat troops to training troops, is a complete disaster, practically speaking, morally speaking, but it's also a political fig leaf that is trying to be constructed by Democrats and some and many Republicans to avoid responsibility for this disaster. So we've got to make sure that they are not allowed to get away with it, number one, and number two, that we continue to push for an actual shift in policy and not a fake shift in policy, which is what they're going to try to get away with this week in the Senate.
Peter Granato is an Iraq war veteran with the group VoteVets.org. They don't support a cutoff for funds, but advocate for a timely withdrawal of U.S. troops. They, too, will lobby Congress in the next few weeks and hold news conferences to advocate their objectives. Granato is concerned with language in many of the proposed amendments that would keep U.S. troops in Iraq to fight al-Qaeda.
So the administration has basically tried to package everything into that's their new packaging now, is they're trying to make everything look like it's an al-Qaeda-related thing. And that's where they're going with it. They're trying to pin every issue in Iraq on al-Qaeda, when mostly everybody knows that there is a small element of al-Qaeda, but that's not the majority of the problem in Iraq. It's a small problem within Iraq, but the administration is trying to use that as an excuse to justify, extended deployments. They're trying to use that to justify more troops, and we don't think that's an appropriate justification.
Media reports reveal that Defense Secretary Gates has canceled his trip overseas to prepare for an Iraq progress report due to Congress by July 15th. The findings of that report could alter the Senate's debate expected to last 2 weeks. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
An estimated 4 million Iraqis have fled their homes since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. Approximately 2 million of those have fled to Jordan and Syria, countries whose governments already struggle to provide for their own citizens. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which requested $60 million in aid for Iraqi refugees at a donor conference in Geneva in April, is now asking for almost twice that much money for the coming year. FSRN's David Enders reports from Jordan.
For the moment, most Jordanians take a congenial view toward Iraqis in the country and refer to them as guests, despite the burden they pose on Jordan's already scarce natural resources and the inflation that has come with this refugee influx equal to about 10% of the country's entire population. Many Iraqis reside in Amman's Mahatta neighborhood, where they receive some assistance from a local church. As he shopped for vegetables, local resident Mahmoud al-Rashid said Iraqis were welcome.
It's better than Iraq. There is terrorism in Iraq. They'll probably stay for a year or two until things cool down and then go back.
UNHCR offers health care and education to Iraqis in Jordan and is making plans to expand its operation as the number of Iraqis applying for assistance increases. Though UNHCR publications refer to resettlement of Iraqi refugees as the only durable solution, it has so far referred fewer than 4,000 Iraqis to third countries. Imran Riza is the UNHCR representative in Amman.
At the moment, we're not, at least here in Jordan, we're focusing very much on the immediate term. I mean, I think all of us are still hoping that there is movement towards a political solution within Iraq. That these people will have the opportunity to return. Certainly when you talk to them, it's clear that most Iraqis that are currently in Jordan want nothing more than returning to a safe, peaceful Iraq.
Many Iraqis in Amman don't believe a solution will be reached anytime soon. 24-year-old Jawad fled Baghdad in 2005 after militiamen accused him of selling cars to a rival militia and tortured him. He is registered with UNHCR and hopes to apply for asylum in Europe or the U.S., but has so far been unsuccessful.
I went to the Australian embassy, and a woman answered the door and gave me a piece of paper with the phone number on it and told me to call. I went to the Dutch embassy, and no one would let me in. It is expensive to go to these embassies. My rent is $100 a month. I don't know what to do. We don't eat lunch sometimes.
Like many Iraqis, his Jordanian visa is long expired and he fears deportation. UNHCR has said it will try to refer as many as 20,000 Iraqis for resettlement by the end of the year. A major part of the problem is the lack of willingness amongst industrialized countries to accept Iraqis, who now make up the largest single group of people seeking asylum in the world. The U.S. took 200 Iraqi asylees last year and says it will take as many as 7,000 this year. In Amman, I'm David Enders for FSRN.
Turkey stands at the brink of launching a military operation in Iraqi Kurdistan as it amasses 140,000 troops at Iraq's northern border. A Turkish military invasion of northern Iraq poses the threat of postponing parliamentary elections scheduled for the 22nd of July. However, Turkish media has recently reported that the government could request parliament's authorization to send the military in as early as this week. Meanwhile, Turkey's highest court has rejected an appeal by the president to quash an upcoming referendum on electoral reforms. The reform package, put forth by the ruling Justice and Development Party, would make it possible for the president to be elected by a popular vote. The office of president is currently elected to a 7-year term by the Turkish parliament. FSRN's Ezgi Sertaj has more from Ankara.
The decision to hold early parliamentary elections came after a Supreme Court verdict nullified the Turkish presidential elections in April. Ali Topuz is a senior deputy member from the main opposition party, the Republican People's Party. He is against the reforms suggested by the government.
Justice and Development Party failed to elect a president in spring, although they held a majority in the parliament. In order to cover their failure, they prepared a reform package in great haste. A new parliament will be formed by August, but by that time the old constitution will still be in force. Even if there will be a referendum and the reforms are approved, it will apply to the presidential elections that will take place in 7 years. A needless debate is created in the parliament by the Justice and Development Party.
The governing party's members welcomed the court's decision, saying it might solve the crisis between rival parties over the election of the new president. Burhan Kuzu is a Justice and Development Party member and is the head of Parliamentary Commission on the Constitution.
The previous court verdict in April nullified the presidential elections and caused a crisis, and the new decision is welcomed as it might solve that crisis.
While the political conflict is seemingly over presidential elections and legal procedures, it points to a deeper divide between secularist elites and the pro-Islamist government. The secularist factions include the army, current president, and the opposition party, the Republican People's Party. Although in Turkey, most of the power is held by the government led by the prime minister, the presidency is also important. The secularist and nationalist elite want this position to be held by one of their members in order to limit the power of a pro-Islamist government. According to opinion polls, the pro-Islamist Justice and Development Party will probably gain a majority in July 22nd elections. Özgür Balkılıç is an analyst based in Ankara.
The Justice and Development Party intends to make some reforms according to the demands of a more Islamic and traditional electorate. The presidency is a very important position in terms of those reforms.
Today, Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan declared that next president will be elected by the new parliament formed after the elections on July 22nd. In that case, a referendum on electoral reforms might not be held at all. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ezgi Sertaş from Ankara, Turkey.
13 people opposed to the privatization of water in El Salvador are facing terrorism charges under the country's new anti-terrorism law. The 13 detainees include two leaders of the Association for the Development of El Salvador, known as CRIPTES by its Spanish acronym. The arrest came as Salvadoran President Tony Saca presented his plan for decentralization of public services in the town of Suchitoto. Opponents to the plan regard it as a clear move toward privatization of public resources, as it gives private and foreign corporations control over the public water system. Leaders of CRIPTES, an organization critical of the privatization plans, were arrested at a police roadblock as they traveled to protest the president's visit. Police charged them with creating public disorder, destruction of property, and now acts of terrorism. All 13 detainees now face trial in special tribunals outside the jurisdiction of the provincial court system.
On Saturday, the judge hearing the case decided to send the 13 to prison for 3 months while charges are further investigated. We're joined on the line by Salvador Marroquin. He's an assembly member of the Association for the Development of El Salvador, or CRIPTES. 13 people are now charged under this brand new anti-terrorism law, but there seems to be absolutely no evidence linking them to any type of violent activity at all. Why do you think that these people were arrested?
Okay, there is a really well-planned strategy for the right wing in this country, in El Salvador, and they are really scary about the power of the people, and they are trying to send a message to the people of this country saying that they can do what they did during the 80s. And there is no evidence, but they know that by making a media show, it's incredible how the TV, the radio station, the newspapers, all are putting the same images, accusing the people before they had been presented to the judges. The CRIPTES has been one organization that from the last 17 years has been working for social justice, for human rights in this country. CRIPTES start working with those people who were displaced by the war. And after the war, the organization has been trying to develop a better life, to develop a better life condition for those who belong to the organization in the same rural communities that once were suffering for the civil war that was financed by the government of the United States of America. The only reason that they have is that the right wing here is afraid of losing the power.
Can you explain this new law that was created, this new anti-terrorism law?
There has been a new law with characterizing, giving to people long prison penalty if they commit something that under this new law is interpreted by them as an act of terrorism. There have been 3 cases now which they are using this new law to keep processing people, and what is important again is the people need to understand that this is a campaign. We are not seeing isolated cases. We are asking the people of the United States of America to please support and denounce what is happening here. We don't want to repeat what this passed during the 80s. We need the support. We know that there is a lot of people in the United States of America who knows about El Salvador. They know the struggle that we have, that we had in the 80s, and they know how hard they fought. They support. They were in solidarity with us, and now is the time that we are asking for that support. 10 years were enough, and you have the right and the power to do something in your hands now. So please act now.
The 13 community members arrested and charged with terrorism after peacefully protesting against water privatization will return to court in 3 months. For more information about CRIPTES, you can log on to www.criptes.org. That's CRIPDES.org. The phenomenal growth of China's economy in recent decades has had uneven benefits. For the 70% of people that reside in rural areas, living standards are often below those of their urban counterparts. One effect of China's move away from socialism is that many rural residents have been left without any means to pay for medical treatment. In the past, local communes had footed the bill, but when the communes disbanded, healthcare became an unaffordable luxury. With more than 700 million people living in rural areas, the government has been under intense pressure to put more money into rural health. And now they're responding with a new rebate scheme aimed at improving access to healthcare in rural areas. FSRN's Elise Botaca takes a look at how the scheme has impacted one small rural hospital.
The Xiamen Town Clinic in China's Qinghai province is bustling with activity. As we walk through the small concrete-floored wards, there are patients recovering from appendicitis, a woman receiving treatment for tuberculosis, and new arrivals are describing their symptoms to doctors. In 2003, the Chinese government initiated a rural healthcare insurance scheme after a survey revealed 73% of people in rural areas couldn't afford to seek medical treatments when needed. It's not uncommon for the cost of treatment to far exceed people's annual incomes. Dr. Wan Xianzhen, who works at a big hospital in Qinghai's capital city, has come to see the new scheme in action.
Wow, it's amazing. When I came here in 3 years ago, no patients.
He explains how under the new scheme, rural citizens pay 10 yuan per year to enroll in the plan.
10 yuan per year, but I can get reimbursed, the government will pay for the patients for 70% for a total of 5,000, so they can get 3,500 reimbursement.
So if they, for a total of 5,000, yeah, they get 75% back?
Yeah, so without this policy, without the insurance, the patients have to pay 5,000 totally by themselves.
So before this policy, you wouldn't have seen so many patients being, yes, able to come to the hospital?
Yes, they stay at home and just wait and control by themselves.
The health plan is designed to bring medical care within reach of rural Chinese, whose average yearly income is around 3,500 yuan. The scheme initially began in a few select counties, but earlier this year, Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao announced that 80% of rural China will be covered by 2008. In this ward, a patient tells Dr. Wang Xianzhen that her family's health has improved since the insurance scheme was introduced. Dr. Wang Xianzhen uses appendicitis as an example. Before the rebate scheme, many people would stay at home hoping the pain would go away. But now this has changed. The clinic's director, Dr. Wang, tells us that the area's poorest patients can get 90% of costs reimbursed. But the influx of patients has created some new problems. One such problem is the lack of space.
This is surgery diagnosis room. This is, the room is still not enough. You know, actually, here is the office for diagnosing, and another separate room is sterilized and it's clean room for suture, for examination. But here is one room to do everything.
As we walk from one small room to the next, Director Wang points out many other areas where the clinic is lacking, including staffing. As yet, funding for the rebate scheme is not being matched by funding for clinic facilities.
We need more doctors, doctor training.
Equipment is also a problem. Here in this tiny tiled room, operations like appendectomies and cesareans are carried out. There's some basic equipment like surgical lights and an anesthetic machine, purchased using donations from the British Embassy. But Director Wang says more equipment, like an ECG monitor, is desperately needed. As we leave the hospital, Director Wang says that this clinic has been designated a model clinic by the central government. But it seems an impossible role to live up to, given the limited resources and the fact that this small hospital serves around 55,000 residents, not only in Xiamen, but from surrounding towns and villages. The central government last year promised an extra 20 billion yuan for new rural facilities, and the clinic is eagerly awaiting the improvements that this might bring. So while the rural health insurance scheme is starting to solve the problem of access and affordability, improved facilities and equipment is the next step. In Qinghai, I'm Elise Portaker for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.